Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. From time to time, we like to provide you with an opportunity to ask some basic questions about personal finance. Kevin Waspy, who lectures on finance at the University of Illinois College of Business, drops by pretty much every month to answer your questions about money management. Whether you are just starting out and looking for advice on investing, thinking about buying a home, sending your children to college, or planning for retirement, your questions are welcome this morning. Kevin Waspy, welcome back to Focus. Glad to have you with us.
Thank you, Craig. It's always good to be here.
And as we begin our discussion, we hope you will call in with your personal finance questions at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Those phone numbers again are 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. And we also welcome your questions on our Facebook page, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. And as always, if you don't call in, I may be forced to talk about the rule of 72. I'd rather not have to go there, but I am prepared to do it, so you have been warned. All right, so let's start here. We won't go to rule of 72 right away. Let's start with the fact that it is the end of October. And by the time we get back together here next month, the holidays will have set in. We'll be through Thanksgiving. People will be thinking about Christmas. They'll be thinking about the end of the year. They may not be thinking about what decisions do I need to make financially before the end of the year. So I thought maybe this would be a good time to brainstorm now. What do we need to take into consideration leading up to December 31st when it comes to our personal finances?
That's a good question. I would say some of the things that would be more appropriate to many would be thinking about budgeting plans for the year ahead. As silly as that sounds, we're not even finished out with 2012, but some of the things that we may be discovering as we approach the year end are we didn't succeed maybe as well as we would have liked to. So this is an opportunity to think a little bit ahead about budgeting and savings. Those kinds of things are never too early to at least consider and put some notes down on a piece of paper.
So what kinds of notes should you put down on that paper? What are the specific things you should think about in terms of this is the money I've spent over the course of the year, here's what I've earned over the course of the year, here's where I kind of feel like I'm sitting, what's going to happen next year?
Well, that's pretty much where it is. Let's just turn back a few minutes ago. We heard the report that was out this morning on personal spending, personal incomes. Both were up. But the interesting part to me was the last part of that news report that said the increase in personal spending for the month was due to more, how should we say, spending of savings. Personal income was up 0.8%. Personal spending was up 0.8%, personal income up 0.4%. So in that month past, people spent out of their savings. So thinking about that, I mean, if that was a planned expenditure, if we were saving money for a specific purchase, whether it's making repairs to a car or repairs to a house, so on and so forth, that's one thing. We can't see those kinds of things in monthly reports like we saw from the Commerce Department, but we don't want to see ourselves in a situation where savings becomes what is being spent.
But does that tend to happen around this time every year anyway? I mean, you know, this is the time of year people are buying gifts and that sort of thing, and maybe, you know, making use of a little bit of disposable income. Is there a natural tendency to do that this fall?
There is certainly seasonality to all of the reports that come out from whatever agency of the government. But in that seasonality, there's also an attempt to adjust those figures for those seasonal impacts. So you and I would look at it and say, well, if you're really a proactive person and you're doing end-of-the-year Christmas shopping or something already, you're probably a lot more organized than I am, at least in that category. But most of what we see in these reports attempts to take that kind of seasonal influence out of it.
So when you hear a report like that, do you think that's good news, that's bad news? How do you
It's both good and bad news. What we see is our economy, like so many mature economies, is in a majority sense driven by consumer spending. our economy, our GDP, is roughly 70% comprised of consumers spending money. So to see a consumer loosen up a little bit of their checkbook during the time that we've seen the slowest recovery from a very stiff recession, that's good news. To see it be sustainable, you'd like to see personal incomes rising at least to meet that, which they weren't and have not been.
And so then how do you translate all of this into an individual's finances? If you see this kind of data, what do you say to somebody who comes to you and says, well, what does this mean for me? Should I be doing what everybody else is doing and spending money? Or?
Sure, and that's the purpose of our call-in show here is to take it to the individual level. Difficult to do, but let me try to stretch that. If I were thinking about what the prospects are for an economic recovery, if I thought about career advancements, career opportunities, so on and so forth, the report we've just seen would tell me that it's still a cautious economy. It's still one where it wouldn't hurt to have a little bit more rather than a little bit less of a cushion of savings. So if I took today's report into an individual level, would I feel comfortable about going absolutely over the top this Christmas season, or would I still be a little frugal? I think I'd err on the side of being a little bit frugal.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is Kevin Wasby. He lectures on finance at the University of Illinois College of Business, and he's here to answer your questions about personal finance. Whether you are just starting out and looking for advice on investing, maybe thinking about buying a home or sending your kids to college or planning for retirement, whatever the case may be, your questions and comments are welcome this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. And we'll begin this morning with David in Urbana. Good morning, David.
Hello. The guest just said something to the effect that this was a very slow recovery, and that does seem to be the consensus, but doesn't seem to me, from a historical standpoint, that it actually has been. It certainly seems slow to any of us who are going through it. But the depression of the 1920s, 30s, the crash was in late 29, but the depression started a couple of years before that. One could easily say it started in 29, or probably 28. By 1936, Roosevelt had brought unemployment down to below 10%. Now, if my math is right, that's 7 years. Am I right?
I'll take that arithmetic.
So it seems to me that we are doing about the same or maybe a little better now. The most severe depression we've ever had was the one that began in 1836 and drug on until the Civil War. That's better than 20 years.
Well, I love the reference to economic history. I think there's good things to be learned from history. But as long as we're on that topic, what this recovery and recession are more akin to, if you really wanted to do some digging, I think would be probably more akin to something like the Panic of 1907. Panic of 1907 was the classic case of bank lending collapsing. In 1933 and 1929, 1928, we had a lot of forces going on that were much more than a monetary system phenomenon. Scholars of those historical events talk about things like the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act. They talk about the collapse of global trade. They talk about a lot of things in addition to a collapse of a financial system. So I think if you really wanted to get a parallel or a comparative, the Panic of 1907 is probably one of the better. Bottom line is, you know, not just a tagline in a political commercial, but the fact is that of recessions that have occurred post-World War II, the trend has been the steeper the recession, the more resilient, the more exuberant the rebound. And with the depth of the recession, with what happened in 2008-2009, I don't think you've seen anywhere near the rebounding return that one would expect with that severity of a decline.
Well, let me ask this just one more sort of big picture question, then we can get back to, you know, personal finance. But what is the healthier economic environment? Stability, even without much economic growth like we have experienced the last couple of years, or volatility that could yield short stretches of significant growth, but also short stretches of significant decline, which is kind of what we experienced in much of the first decade of the 2000s.
Well, I mean, the volatility is certainly something that makes planning and therefore economic activity itself a lot more difficult, a lot more challenging. So, you know, variability is something that you'd like to avoid. But the trend line is probably the most important thing. If we saw trend line growth that were 3.5%, 3.75%, as opposed to trend line growth that we would say is closer to 2.5% or even 2%.
Yeah, but
that's
how,
a powerful number over time.
How far over time should you look for that trend line growth? I mean, is it a trend line that you want to look at over in 10-year stretches, in 20-year stretches, or year to year? What's the better, more instructive variable to look at?
Right. Year to year is certainly something that's going to show volatility in any environment. So, you know, year to year is not where it's at. But over a 10-year, over a 20-year, incorporating things like the business cycles that go within them. But certainly, if you're not looking over a 10-year trend, then you're probably seeing more noise than you're seeing information.
And I guess that would apply then also to personal finances. If you're making an investment and you want to have a sense of whether it pays off, it's always nice to look at those quarterly reports you might get in the mail from your, you know, 401k or mutual fund or what have you. But you kind of want to look at how has this particular plan performed over 5 years, 10 years, 20 years versus how did it perform the last 90 days.
Oh, right? I'd say that's very true. Looking at things more frequently only creates too many opportunities to second guess yourself. I mean, a true investment should be something that pays off over a long run, not something that should be measured quarter to quarter.
David in Urbana wanted to chime back in. Let's give him a chance to do so, and then we'll move on from there. David, go ahead.
Yes. As to comparing the present, I think we should call it a depression, not a recession, to 1907. I think you're mistaken in saying that this is more closely related to that than the 29 collapse. In both cases, all three cases, there was a bubble that burst. But the underlying problems in the economy today, it seems to me, are much more akin to those of the 20s than of 07. The income distribution is so skewed today that it really inhibits the recovery, with a very high concentration of wealth among a very few people and a very large number of people in near poverty. It's very difficult to bring an economy out of a depression. And it seems to me that what happened in the 20s is much more akin to what is happening now than 07, or for that matter, 1836, which was gross mismanagement by a president. Incidentally, one of our more beloved presidents for some reason. But okay. I would appreciate your comment.
All right, thanks.
Very
thanks
good.
Anything else you wanted to say along those lines? Nope. Okay, we'll move on. We have an email from Roana who asks, my husband and I are looking to buy our first place within the next 3 years. We're hoping to buy property and build our dream house on it. To that end, we've been working toward improving our credit and getting our financial picture ready for such a purchase. It will take us 3 years to save the down payment. Is there anything that we should be aware of with this kind of house purchase? Are there additional hidden costs to building our own home rather than buying one already built? And what should we be looking to avoid to make the most of our money while still having the home we dream of?
Yeah, that's a multifaceted question.
Yeah. Sure, let's take them one at a time. So is there anything they should be aware of with this particular type of house purchase?
In terms of building as opposed to buying?
I would say both cases, yeah.
Well, obviously the need to be more wary of what is actually done during a process of construction. I mean, I have no idea how familiar the person is with construction methods or how able they would be to monitor what happens, how it happens, and to what level of quality. Construction projects are not simple things. How they actually handle it, is there going to be a general contractor that manages all of the subcontractors? Is there a structure of payments such that they don't end up with a possibility of having mechanics liens on the house after they thought they'd paid for everything? These are extremely, I would guess, nitpicky type of things that they certainly should feel comfortable with, much more so than would be needed if they were to buy something that's pre-existing.
Any additional hidden cost to building our own home rather than buying one already built?
Well, again, I don't know what a builder is going to quote a per square footage and so on and so forth. That's easy arithmetic on a piece of paper. But when it comes down to the all-in, all-done price, it's a little bit like, you know, if I buy a new car, it comes with a warranty. If I buy a used car, it's a whole lot cheaper. But then there are all those little things that kind of happen along the way that we didn't plan on. I would say that building is a little bit like that aspect. You can't imagine everything in advance, and I doubt whether you can contract for every little nuance in advance. Before we get that kitchen floor in, I've changed my mind. I want to go with this instead of that. Well, you know, we've already got a restock order or a restock charge on the material that, you know, we did have ready to go. This material costs a little bit more. There's going to be a little extra labor involved with that. And, you know, all of those kinds of things I can see just from having done small remodel projects, much less an entire out-of-the-ground house. Those kinds of potentials are there. Not to say that they're unmanageable, but I would certainly say that it's going to require more time, effort, prudence, involvement on the part of the buyer to manage those things.
And then the last question was, what should we be looking to avoid to make the most of our money while still having the home we dream of? So is there any sort of red flags? Oh, you want to make sure to keep an eye out for this or that as you go through the process.
I'm not a real estate specialist by any means, and I'm certainly not a contractor. But it just seems to me that if, like most of us, we probably have one of the largest expenditures we'll ever make is buying the house that we live in. I would certainly say that the real estate people have pounded one thing into me over time, and that is location, location, location. So to some aspect, even if you feel it's going to be the house that you plan to live in for the rest of your life, there needs to be good sense paid to it, whether you're building it or buying it as existing, to the potential for resale. So certainly don't overlook what you think is attractive may not be attractive to the next buyer.
Well, or may not be attractive to you 10, 20, 30 years down the road.
Right.
It may be your dream house today. It may not be tomorrow.
I remember avocado green appliances.
Right.
They were hot in the late 60s, yes. Yeah. but not for long.
Right. And yet they remained in homes for many, many years beyond the time they were hot. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is Kevin Waspy, who lectures on finance at the University of Illinois. It's our regular program on personal finance, and we welcome your questions on money management, whether you are seeking investment advice, considering a large purchase, maybe like a home or a car, maybe trying to deal with bills, both large and small, maybe you're planning for retirement. Whatever the case may be, you can call us this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Remember, we also welcome questions and comments on our Facebook and Twitter pages. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media.
You know, earlier, Craig, you'd brought up the possibility of thinking about things as we get closer to the year end. One thing that people who own mutual funds may want to think of now is those types of, how should we say, surprises they would receive with capital gain distributions and the tax implications of any of those as we approach. So just in a nutshell, most mutual funds will distribute their capital gains that they've been accumulating over the past 10 months sometime at the end of October, certainly as we get into the first part of November. And those distributions are taxable even if the person taking that distribution is reinvesting them in the shares of the fund. So again, we're talking about mutual funds outside of things like IRA accounts, outside of things like 403B or 401K accounts, so personal investment mutual funds. Those types of gains then might be less attractive depending on how the fund has created them and classifies them. So, again, this is sort of like that time of the year again. If in prior years you received a large capital gain that was reinvested in the shares of the fund, but you didn't like the tax impact of that, potential is now to think about that before it occurs again. Not to advocate a sale of the fund or anything such like that, but just to say there's something that the mailbox may be holding for us in the coming month.
How much money do you recommend we should keep on hand for that rainy day? Not hurricane rainy day, but just something, some big something that could come down the road that could be many thousands of dollars. I mean, or maybe you find yourself out of work, or maybe you find yourself with less income than you had before, or something, some significant cost that you didn't incur before.
Yeah,
how do you plan for that?
That's a tough question, and it's such a variable. I mean, I could answer with something very patent, like you should have 3 months of gross income sitting in a savings account. But I think there's way too many variables in most people's lives that might impact that and maybe even require much less than that amount of money in liquid savings. Things like the cost of health care we know are extremely, expensive. So what impact to health care, and what is the reason you find yourself needing that savings? All of those types of things I think are best put together in a full financial plan. I think each person's unique characteristics and the situation that they find themselves in probably comes up with a much better answer. I could say something silly like the more the better, but that would only be a starting point. Again, for each person, depending on their circumstances, depending on what happens to, and then we start filling in the blanks. Is there a house payment? How much is the house payment? Where does the money come from? Is there disability insurance in place? If there's a disability that causes a loss of income, is there health insurance? How much of that health insurance is available in a loss of income situation? All of those things are big variables that come into play. Again, starting with the simple, the more the better, but we have to be practical too.
Well, and it really is a question. I mean, I think in my own finances, I worry about, well, do I have enough money in a savings or a checking account for whatever that thing is that may happen? Is there a point at which I've reached a threshold where maybe I've got too much in there and I really should be putting some of that away in some sort of investment? I've got those other investments out there, but once you put some money into, say, a 401k or, some sort of pension or something, the intent is to put it there to stay there and not to draw it back out.
Right, right. And that's the balance that we run. So when I would say something like, you should have 3 months, that might not be appropriate for a person that has very little, what I would say is mandatory have to happens every month. You or I could walk around and try to plan for the ultimate apocalypse, but why?
Right.
I mean, to take it to an extreme is rather silly. So if a person can handle what they would say are their normal month-to-month requirements and can handle them for, let's say, 3 or 4 months with an interruption in income, I think that would be a prudent place to be. and adjustments, you know, to be made above or beyond. If you have the type of qualifications that even in today's economy might mean that you could become employable very quickly, that's one thing. If you have any kind of career that is in some way related to a technology that is easily transferable, it's a much different circumstance than a person who has a unique skill set but is not very transferable.
We need more public radio. Oh, never mind. I'm not going to go there. Let's go to an email. We have Michael. His email, he asks, where would I start looking for a retirement annuity? What is a good return for someone 62 years old, and how do I figure this out?
Sure. It's an email, so I really can't ask a question. But if Michael would like to call in, that would be fine. A retirement annuity. I guess I would ask, why do you want an annuity? And if the reason is for the simple purpose that annuities serve best, that is to guarantee a certain amount of income for life, then I think any qualified, what I would say is reputable insurance person would be happy to help Michael or anyone else shop for a good retirement income annuity. Annuities are an insurance policy, and once we get inside the candy shell, just like an M&M, there are other things going on inside of it. So depending on what, if there are other objectives that the emailer is looking for, maybe some of those objectives are better served without having the candy coating of an annuity.
We're taking your questions on personal finance for Kevin Waspy. He lectures on finance at the University of Illinois College of Business. And you can call us this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we will take some of your phone calls and emails after a short break. This is Focus.
This is WILL Station Manager Bob Culkeen. Our fall pledge drive concluded with outstanding support from you, our listeners. You raised more than $107,000 for WILL, Illinois Public Media, your local public radio station. Thank you to the 758 listeners who made a pledge of support during the drive and to our sustainers, underwriters, and friends. Your continued support is greatly appreciated and helps us maintain quality programs that we bring to you every day. Thank you.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the 4th Annual Champaign-Urbana Folk and Roots Festival, November 2nd and 3rd in downtown Urbana, with over 70 artists performing blues, jazz, old-time, Cajun, bluegrass, and Irish music. The festival also features storytelling, Saturday workshops, and family activities. Schedules and information at cufolkandroots.org.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. Pretty much every month, Kevin Waspy joins us to take your questions on personal finance. Kevin lectures on finance at the University of Illinois College of Business. Whether you are just starting out and looking for advice on investing, maybe thinking about buying a home or sending your children to college or planning for retirement, your questions are welcome this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL, or you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. Gas prices, I guess, have for the most part dropped a bit recently in recent months, but we have been in the $3 to $4 range for a while. The cost of food in most restaurants goes up over time in grocery stores. I guess this is a natural progression. Prices rise over time. How do you know how best to budget for the long haul, taking increasing prices like that into account?
Yeah, the cost of things that every one of us has to deal with every month have certainly gone up faster than any measured rate of inflation. Those types of things are, you know, I guess, the sad fact of what we're seeing right now. We're seeing incomes a little slowly adjusting to things like energy and food prices. That said, there's a lot of volatility in those latter two. We've seen gas prices are, you know, the easiest things to see. You just drive down, walk down the street, whatever you want to do, you'll see those signs up there right in front of your face. We go to the store, we see the the cost of the goods. It's a very visible measure. What we're not seeing is some of the declines in prices that we kind of take for granted. Some of the technological advances that we've seen that are allowing prices for consumer goods to fall, that's the good side of the equation. So when we go to measure an all-out cost of living index or something, all of those prices get matched together and we see what at least is a historical low rate of inflation. You asked the question, how to budget, how to plan, and my guess would be something like this. Plan on it costing more in the future, it being food, it being energy, just because those things, at least historically, have cost us more. Now, if somebody comes up with cold fusion in a box tomorrow, then I think that forecast of higher energy costs is thrown out the window, but I'm not going to make my bet on cold fusion in a box tomorrow.
But I guess then the question becomes, how much more? How do you know how much more all the things that you spend money on today will cost 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, so that as you get closer and closer to retirement, whatever age you may be now, you have a sense of this is how much it will cost for me to live for, say, a year without any income. This is how much I'll expend, how much I need to save for this year and then for the next year and then for the next year.
Right.
How do you calculate that?
Right. Well, then you have to resort to some, blended result. If a person were to look at long-term prices, long-term being the past 50 years, and say things without putting them into compartments, then you probably ought to plan on a 3% per year increase in prices. Is healthcare going to cost 3% more? Well, certainly not based on the past 25 years of increases. Is tuition going to cost only 3% per year more? Well, certainly not based on the past 15 years. So every category is going to be different. Energy, food, tuition, housing, taxes, everything is going to be a little bit different. If you're going to make a planning goal, go for a long-run average of all prices and say, well, plan on 3% more. Now, the interesting thing I'll ask you is this, Craig. When you're retired, will you be spending as much on fill in the blank, as much on entertainment, as much on travel, as much on energy, as much on, all of those things are going to shift to some degree in your lifestyle change. So in not working every day, I would imagine whatever expense you have in going to and from work will probably be less. Hmm. If that translates into a lesser use of energy, I wouldn't be surprised.
Well, I guess taking that example forward, it might be lesser use of energy in terms of gas in a car or something like that, but it might be more in terms of having the heat or the AC on all the time at home, if you're home all the time.
Well, I mean, that is a trade-off. Yeah. We're all talking about how to budget, not how to debate.
Right.
So, understood, there's going to be changes in your lifestyle. If you can pinpoint any reasonable change in your lifestyle that might impact some of the larger expenditures, then maybe you can make some fine-tuning. But let me get back to my first statement. That's why we'd probably say something like, let's look at the long-term price levels and just say, well, let's try to budget a 3% across the board.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. Pretty much every month, Kevin Wasby joins us to take your questions on personal finance. Kevin lectures on finance at the University of Illinois College of Business. Whether you're just starting out or looking for advice on investing, thinking about buying a home, sending your kids to college, or planning for retirement, your questions are welcome this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, and that's what a listener in Champaign has done, indicating this person has invested in a long-term care insurance policy for his wife. And the individual says, after a horrendous recent experience communicating with the customer service department, trying to get an extra copy of the policy, I've started worrying about its worth. If we're old and feeble when she uses it, we're worried how we would cope with a resistant, non-complying company when we need it. Can you tell me anything about trying to sue an insurance company to get the promised benefits? What court would I take it to? Also, in general, how are insurance companies able to offer a 5% inflation adjustment every year when interest rates and growth are so slow?
Yeah, lots of good questions. As it relates to any involvement with insurance-type products, what I would suggest this person or any consumer to do is to contact the state insurance commissioner's office. If they're having trouble with an agent or the company itself, insurance companies need to be licensed to offer product in the state in which they operate. So I'm assuming it's Illinois that this person lives in, so that would require filing with the state office of insurance commissioner if they think they have a problem, or if it's just something as simple as getting a copy of a policy for review purposes. I'm not an attorney, so I'm not going to say anything about what does it take to sue an insurance company. I'm totally off the topic there. But I would say a good place for any consumer of insurance to start, if they have a problem with understanding what they have from their company, is go to the state office for insurance regulation.
And I imagine it doesn't matter where the insurance company itself is located.
That is correct.
Because they have to be licensed in whatever state you live in if they want to sell insurance to you.
Correct. Right.
Let's take a couple more calls. We'll go next to Mary in Champaign. Hi, Mary.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I tell you what my situation is. And I'd like some advice or an answer, maybe. I recently put the real estate I have into a trust. And that's fine. That's nothing you fiddle around with. But I understand that to avoid probate, the most amount of titleable assets you can have is $100,000, which isn't a whole lot of money in this day and age, in the way of CDs or a car or things like that. Now, I've got several children, and if I took out simultaneously, because I'm trying to be very, very fair with them, the same size CD with each one and had a POD with it, would that POD not, would it flag an audit, or would it not flag an audit if I was over $100,000?
Yeah, again, I am not an attorney, but to the best of my understanding, POD, or paid on death, would not move the asset out of a potential probate issue. So in other words, you obviously have some relationship with an attorney that helped you set up a property trust.
Correct.
I would say that good follow-up questions for them, talking about your attempt, your desire, your question about moving assets such to, how should we say, not have a probatable estate is something that you need to talk with him about, or her.
Okay, well, you answered my question. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. We'll go next to Shirley in Muhammad. Hi, Shirley.
Hi, good morning. My husband and I are both 80, and we have CDs coming due, and it seems to me that municipal bond funds like BlackRock are a pretty good place to put money because they're paying 6% tax-free. And I haven't been able to find a site on the web that gives me a lot of information about them. For example, how many years they go out or whatever. Can you help me?
You mentioned BlackRock. Is this an exchange-traded fund of BlackRock that has this dividend yield?
Yes. It's a closed-end fund.
Yes, closed-end exchange-traded right. fund. Yeah.
BlackRock, PIMCO has them, and also Nuveen, but it seems like BlackRock has about 20 of them. And as I say, they're paying 6% tax-free, which looks pretty good to me.
Right. I know you're attracted to that yield. Anyone would be in today's low-rate environment. But just a real rough rule of thumb, the higher the rate of return in any environment, the higher the risk. So You'd mentioned that both your husband and yourself are 80 years old.
Right.
And I would say, please look beyond what is, you know, an income yield at the moment. There's a reason why that is so attractively high.
And what is it? What's the reason?
I have two guesses. The first guess is that the quality of the bonds in there is rather low. The second guess is the length to maturity is quite long, 15 to 20 years, maybe longer than 20 years. And that's about the only reason I can come up with to see a tax-exempt yield in the 6% neighborhood. Those are the kind of things that you will find out when you look at the individual prospectus on a closed-end mutual fund, an exchange-traded fund, whatever we want to call it. And those are available. Do you have a computer?
Yes.
Those are available from the Securities and Exchange Commission website. So if you just go into your computer address or the URL address at the top, and just go ahead and type SEC, Sam Edgar Charles, .com, or excuse me, .gov. SEC.gov will take you to the Securities and Exchange webpage.
Okay.
And from that page, you can see filings. There's a very nice example or explanation of all of the information that firms have to file with the SEC to publicly disclose everything about those investments that are offered to the public.
Okay.
So you could go to the Edgar, E-D-G-A-R database is what it's called. And again, this is easier when you're there and can see it. It's very self-explanatory. They'll even give you a little primer on what the Edgar database is and how it works. But literally, there will be a search box. You can go right into the search box with the company name and see all of the different products that they offer. Within there, you'll be able to see things like the most recent annual report that will show you the actual portfolio of securities.
Okay. Other than inflation, these still look like a pretty good deal to me.
Well, just to remind you, the lower the quality of the bond and the longer the term to maturity, the more volatile will be the price of the bond. So it's a little bit like saying, you know, if you don't mind seeing the value of what you're putting your money into increase or decrease quite rapidly, that's okay. But
uh-huh.
when I said, you know, higher returns come with higher risk, with this particular type of product, the biggest risk you probably face right now is interest rate risk. Long-term bonds vary in value inversely to moves in interest rates. So if 2 or 3 years or 4 or 5 years from now, interest rates are higher, the value of what you own may very well be lower.
Okay.
If you don't mind seeing what you paid a dollar for now worth 80 cents, well, then that's what you've got to know up front.
Well, what other alternative do I have? You know, what else can I get into that would replace the CDs?
Well, anything that is in the fixed income category is going to bring you into the low interest rate environment that we're in. So if you bought municipal bonds again, assuming that the tax-exempt income status makes sense for you, given your tax status, those are attractive, but you could do two things. You could search for other municipal income funds that have higher quality bonds and a little shorter term to maturity. Maybe the yields on them would only be 3.5% to 4%. Maybe a blend or a mix of some of the Blackstone 6% type of yield that you were talking about product and some more conservative ones with lower ones would be in order. And again,
okay. And again,
you'd be following a little bit of a prudence in diversification and not having so much in one product.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much for the call. We have an email from Susan in Urbana who asks, several years ago, I signed on with a debt settlement company to help pay off my credit cards. I've been able to pay off over half of my debt for a reduced price. I have just one credit card left to pay, and the balance is frozen at $3,000. I recently got married, and my husband and I were able to start a joint savings account with about $6,000. Is it wiser to keep this money in savings or to pay off my final credit card balance and start fresh with no credit card debt? The debt settlement process has hurt my credit rating, and I will need to rebuild my rating for our future. And Susan says, we do both have student loans that we are paying off, but we would like to get out of the credit card debt first.
Yeah, I would first congratulate her in making the progress that she's made. That's very laudable. I would say off of what you've just told me and nothing more, I would pay off that remaining balance and work on restoring your credit rating. That would just put that chapter behind us and not have any more clouds moving further in your future. I don't want the person to think that that this is, you know, cutting off their nose to spite their face, but that was an obligation. They were able to make an arrangement, an agreement, a negotiated settlement. So I would be done with it as soon as I could.
We have a few minutes left, and I guess we should point out for our regular Focus listeners who pay attention to this online, we have the monthly Couch Potato Portfolio, this custom portfolio for savvy long-term investors from Focus, and you brought in the most recent report of that. You want to take maybe a moment to walk us through what it says and what we could glean from it?
Well, longtime listeners of this show know that David Sinnoh put this together quite a number of years ago. This is, I would say, the ultimate buy-and-hold type strategy. So it's a mix of low-cost index-type mutual funds. And I only bring the update in for those listeners that do like to get a sense of where it stands. I know that a number of people are followers of it, maybe even investors in it. Last month when I was in, we had seen a pretty nice recovery to U.S. stock markets, and things were looking much better than they were for a majority of the year. This month, we've seen a little bit of a downtick, but still year to date, the couch potato portfolio, which is a mix of stocks, bonds, real estate, so on and so forth, is up just under 13%. So it's been a nice annual rate of return, at least to date. This is through Friday's closing prices. So at least to date. One of the things that was interesting to me is seeing the big change that's occurred in 1 month. A month ago, most of the foreign investments were negative, and now those have turned positive with some of the more recent developments in Europe. So I guess things are looking a little bit better, even, you know, outside the United States.
Well, perhaps. either things are looking a little bit better, or is it safer to say the perception that some have is that things are a little bit better, and so therefore those investments are seeing greater returns?
Well, then we could resort to one of my favorite, and that is perception is reality.
Oh, okay. Well, that could spring us off into a whole other topic that would cover more than just an hour, I think.
Oh, and indeed. Not to be silly about it or anything else, but the performance of markets in Europe over the past month certainly lend one to believe that things might be better than they were 2 or 3 months ago. Remember, 2 or 3 months ago, you know, most of the talk coming out of the European economic markets was, will or will not Spain be the next domino to topple? And those remarks have certainly become many fewer and less frequent.
We have just a minute left. Any particular advice, thoughts, just general observations about the state of our finances today collectively and what it means for individual investors?
Yeah, I think some of the questions that we had today really brought out one thing to me that we should all kind of keep in our minds, and that is wherever we look for a rate of return, look for it with reason. Look for it with the knowledge that there are explanations for why something might appear to be much more attractive than another thing. We live in a world where rates of return on things like CDs, bonds, anything related to interest income is extremely low. And it's painful for people that have saved and invested and have a bulk of their wealth now invested in things like fixed income securities. But that painful process shouldn't allow a person to do things that they really would rather not do, simply because they're chasing a yield. So caution, caution, caution comes to mind. We don't have to look for Armageddon, but we don't want to find ourselves behind a speedboat water skiing when all we really wanted to do was dip our toes in the water.
Kevin Wasby lectures on finance at the University of Illinois College of Business. Kevin, as always, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Craig. It's been good.
We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. That's will.illinois.edu/focus. On tomorrow's show, we'll talk with writer Paul Tough. You may have heard him on This American Life or read some of his articles about character and childhood in the New York Times Magazine and The New Yorker. He has a new book out entitled How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. We'll talk with him about that book. That's on tomorrow's show. Today's program was produced by Travis Stanzel. Kyle Mabry is our technical director. He handled your calls today. I'm Craig Cohen. Thanks for joining us.